If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Started recording when I have started recording.
Yeah.
So it has been nearly a month since I recorded a podcast. It's 2 days short of a month. And there's been a multitude of reasons for that. Part of it is that I have needed to have a rest of everything. Part of it is that I've just not had the time because I've got a lot of other stuff going on. And part of it is that I could not be fucked. I'll be perfectly honest. Putting it simple, I couldn't be fucked. I just needed an absolute break from a lot of life. And a lot's been going on over the last month. Some good, some bad. We're going into another fucking lockdown. I'm wearing sunglasses because it's really, really bright outside. Like, if I take them off, my tiny eyes will be really tiny. So you see why I'm wearing them. And so today, I have Louise, who is there. And I've known Louise now, I think, for... it's got to be 4 years.
I think it was about 4 years, yeah.
And we met in Richmond Park... and it was purely because I saw your bike. And I thought it was cool. That's pretty much how we met.
It was, yeah. You were doing loads of laps. I was doing loads of laps. But we were going the opposite direction. So, like, every 10 minutes, we would see each other. And I think for the first few times, just, like, a little nod. And then we started waving. And then it was like, woohoo, after about 20 times. And then the next time, I was like... where's he gone? And then suddenly you came up behind me and then we started chatting.
And that was, it's probably 4 years ago now. And
I think it's 4 years in the summer, so it's over 4 years ago. Yeah, I was training for like Ride London or something the next weekend, and you were like, you'd already done your 24 hours in Richmond Park. So you're like, yeah, I'm just here for most of the day, but it's not a big deal because I just did a whole day here. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was quite new. Cycling at the time, and I'd never encountered anyone like you who just ride for 24 hours. But yikes.
What an idiot, eh?
Right? You haven't changed.
No, who'd think that was the start of the serious 24 hours?
Yeah. Yeah. And then 107, I suppose, came the year after that. And
then actually,
that's when I met everyone. All the Atticus lot and all of those at your 107 Regent's Park thing before you went off to Flanders.
That was I started 107 the year that we would have met in the winter.
Yes.
And I finished it in the, I finished it the day before Flanders, which was 2017?
Must be.
Feels like ages ago. And went out there and did that crazy like day where it was just like, oh my God, I couldn't even think how many people turned up. It was insane.
It was crazy.
I've never seen Regent's Park so busy as it was on that day. But then again, I do not ride in Regent's Park very much since then.
You'll never
I hate it. I can't stand it. I went there this morning. I can't stand it because I think I've just outridden it.
Yeah.
But I could tell you, like, it's a great resource for central London, for cyclists in central London, if you're not close to Richmond Park, for example. But it's so busy. It's always busy. And I don't, and it's not so much necessarily the cyclists. It's more the rat runners, taxis and lorries and stuff that cut through. I think make it quite dangerous.
There has been a few crashes, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's like a dog run, like even trying to drop in sometimes, you have to wait for a gap and
it's not great. I mean, the inner circle is like probably like 1 kilometer of some of the best tarmac I've ever ridden. Like it's, but it's just a 1 kilometer circle.
Yeah.
And the outer circle and the inner circle, like you can actually, you could ride that and you probably won't get that interrupted, but the outer circle, there's always traffic around. And I think it's just because of its location. There's a lot of chat going on about how to improve that. There has been for ages and I just don't think they've quite figured it out yet. Because, I mean, it is a fantastic resource for London, but when you go and cycle in other parts of the country, it's shit. It's really shit.
I just enjoyed it. I live out of towns, but I go in and do it sometimes just for the social side of things. It's fun. If you're meeting people, then go for coffees and stuff like that. But it's certainly not the best riding, that's for sure.
Mm. It's interesting at the moment because, like, there's been obviously cycling has very clearly, grown definitely in the UK since the first lockdown, but probably internationally as well. And like, I look at it that there was that big growth in 2012.
Mm-hmm. But yes,
pre and post Olympics and Tour de France and Bradley Wiggins won, and then there was then it kind of seemed to like taper down a bit, and it feels like there's been another big influx of people starting to ride again because of, like, you know, the support to get people on bikes, the support with the paying for maintenance in bike shops, the changes on, like, all the changes that are supposedly going on with the highway code supporting cyclists a bit more. Don't know if that's actually happened or not. And then in London, how much of London has been turned into cycle lanes, or for example, the road, which for me that I would ride if I went to Regent's Park, which is along past King's Cross Station in Euston, that's got a dedicated cycle lane in it now with bollards to protect it. So it's so much safer. So there's definitely, like, it feels like there's another growth again. It's interesting. I don't think you're going to get a big bump like we did during the first lockdown for this lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just because of the weather changing.
Yeah.
But I guess you never know. You never know. Having spoken to a few bike shops and stuff, and they're kind of anticipating there still to be a lot of interest, but probably more looking at like mountain bikes and gravel bikes.
Right.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah, it's a strange one. It's a really, really strange one. I hate the fact that we're going into a second lockdown, but I think it's the right thing to do.
Something needs to be done, that's for sure. The numbers are really concerning.
Yeah. And it was raised to me yesterday that I didn't realise actually, is, you know how like Liverpool, Manchester, etc. have been in like a lot more serious lockdown recently.
Yes.
But the amount of cases in the southwest, so Bristol, Swindon, that way, have been the same as like Liverpool, Manchester.
And oh, they really?
Yeah.
Why haven't they shut down then?
I don't know.
That doesn't make sense.
Nope. I was looking into it yesterday and I was just like, that makes no sense at all. But I mean, I think as a, you know, the UK as its own entity should be going into lockdown, definitely. The cases are rising.
Wales are just about to come out of their lockdown, which is ridiculous too. it's just a mess.
The problem is consistency in an island.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same problem they're having in Europe. You know, you think if France borders Belgium and then sort of the French, Spanish, Belgium, Dutch kind of borders all kind of cross, especially France, Belgium and the Netherlands, because they're so close.
Yeah.
They've all got different rules. And like, you literally don't know if you're cycling in one or the other at points.
No, not like there's a border control or anything.
Yeah, you'd only get a border control on like some of the major motorways, and it's not even border control, it's purely like because there'll be a toll on the road or something, that's what it'd be. It's gonna be interesting
what happens with this lockdown, and see if it is the month or whether it extends again, like back in the summer when it was 3 weeks, then three, another three, another three, another three, and you're like, oh man.
I think it's going to be extended. I'm fully preparing to have a lockdown birthday.
Oh, what date's your birthday?
18th of December.
Maybe.
Yeah. And I've already accepted that I'm having Christmas at home. Like, as in, at my home. Yeah. I mean, it's no different to usual, to be honest with you, but I've pretty much, like, accepted that, yeah. Like,
yeah.
Because I can't go to the Isle of Man because their borders are closed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, gosh.
Yeah, you get thrown in prison.
Oh, man. Well, they're probably not New Zealand. They're like, we're okay here. We don't want anyone else coming and ruining it.
Yeah, so it was my sister's wedding on Saturday, and I couldn't go.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, because I literally can't get over there.
Yeah.
And then it was... So there's no point in me, I can't go there. And then my mum is a high risk person. So I shouldn't go there. So I was just like, yeah, cool. We'll have Christmas here. Eat something. I don't know, I could find some paper or something. Yeah.
Some paper. Oh, yeah. Unwrap your presents and then eat the wrapping paper.
Yeah, it's fine, isn't it? I've probably got a bit of carbon. Just eat some carbon. Yeah, there's a bit of carbon. We'll have that for...
Fork, not that kind of fork for your Christmas dinner.
Yeah, use that fork for Christmas dinner, you know, just dip it in there. So I don't know, it's going to be interesting. And anyway, on that note, let's yeah. talk about internationals.
Yes.
Now,
sorry. Yeah.
You're the best person to explain this, so I'm not going to try and butcher it, so I'm going to let you explain what internationals is.
Okay. Well, I'll start from the beginning. So internationals, we formed last year, 2019, because basically there's a French group called Donon des Elo Velo, which is a group of women that ride the full Tour de France each year, the day before the men, in basically for equality, because there isn't a women's Tour de France. And there's a massive gender gap in cycling. So they ride each year, and each year they open up to applications for people to join the team. Last year, so many non-French people joined, they actually put us all in touch with each other and said, why don't you form your own international team to ride with us? So that's what we did. So a few of us were interested, a few people who had applied then couldn't do it, because it's quite a big commitment to, you know, take the 3 weeks in France and all the training that was in it. Yeah. Plus, we were completely self-funded, so it was a massive commitment. So not everyone who'd applied to the French team and who was international wanted to be part of the new team. But there was a few of us, and then we kind of roped in some extra friends and stuff like that to make it a viable team. So there was 10 of us, 10 riders, and we had 4 support crew, which basically filled 2 vans. And that's what made the logistics make sense for the, you know, most cost-effective option for getting around the full route. So we actually met for the first time in Brussels for stage one of the tour, because we were from all over the world. I knew a couple of the British riders, and I'd met in France the American rider and our road captain, a French guy at the time. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, we didn't know each other, so it was pretty interesting, like going into that kind of thing with a bunch of strangers, like a major social experiment of like, here's pretty much the most tiring and stressful thing you could ever do in your life with a bunch of strangers.
Yeah.
But it was incredible. So yeah, we did really well. We completed the full tour. And we actually rode further than the men did last year, because a couple of their stages were cancelled. In fact, I think you were out in France at the time, weren't you, when there was that massive landslide and the crazy weather. We rode through that.
Yeah, I was out there watching the stage before the landslide.
Okay.
It had like 3 massive hills in it.
Yes.
It was a stage at Quintana won.
Galibier, Izoard, Col de Var, that one.
Yeah, that one.
That was bad, that stage. That was a long day.
Yeah, I was there. I was out there for that stage, and then I was coming back the day, which was when the landslide was.
Yeah. That it was crazy. So we'd come off of Col d'Isère, which was the, I think that's like the highest paved road in Europe or something. It was mega. So at the top of that, it was snowing. At the bottom, it was 40 degrees. But at the bottom, the weather just changed. And the rain as we were riding up to Team was just horrendous. And then when we finished it, we got in our van to do our transfer to the next stage. And it was hammering on the roof of the van so loud.
It
was serious. But then it rained all night. And then I think that's what caused then the mudslide the next day. But the next day we were then on the next stage, which was also massive. And that was cut short for the pros their next day as well. So they never did the, I think it was the Corme de Roseland or something like that, that they just cut that out. And that was a 30 kilometer climb. So I think we ended up climbing 50 or 60 more kilometers than the guys, two more mountains. We got a lot of people talking about the whole reason why we do this, about the whole equality in cycling thing. And the most interesting thing is so many people don't realize there isn't a women's Tour de France. They just presume that they haven't watched it or they haven't heard about it. And then you say, no, actually, you know, there isn't one for varying reasons. Originally, they were saying women weren't capable and stuff like that. And now that's no argument at all, because if a bunch of amateurs like us can ride the full Tour de France, of course the professionals can. So there's all sorts of, you know, excuses about, oh, logistics and sponsors and stuff like that. And it is tricky, because who's going to sponsor something that has no coverage? So it's a whole load of stuff that needs to be addressed. And the ASO keep, you know, hinting at, oh, we'll do something. But they just don't give any details about it at all. So it's just like, well, that's just saying it. You're not actually doing it. So we're going to be riding again next year. I've completely skipped this whole year. So this year we were due to ride the Tour de France again. And then the COVID's happened, which put, you know, everyone's plans into complete turmoil. So it was a real tricky one. And we've got half new team, half last year's riders. People couldn't all commit to doing it again this year. So we've got five new riders, and we're based all over the world again. We've got a bunch in America, Australia, UK, Netherlands. So we're all over the place. And we hoped actually when the Tour de France got pushed back this year that would give us, you know, another... I think it was about 10 weeks it got pushed back. It was a couple of months anyway.
Yeah.
And we thought, oh, that'll be time for, you know, coronavirus to do one. But it wasn't enough time for it to do one. So we had the travel issue with our American riders couldn't even get into France because they locked the borders to US citizens.
Yeah.
We would have had the issue of the Brits having to quarantine when we got back. Our Australian rider would have had to have quarantined at her own expense at the Sydney Hotel Airport on return for 2 weeks. So all of us were just like, oh my gosh, this is a nightmare. And is it actually the right thing to be seen to be doing, tootling around France on our bikes during a global pandemic, chatting about equality? So we were like, let's go for a plan B, which is when we decided to just do something else within, you know, government restrictions from home in a much safer environment, but still trying to do something to be able to talk about all of the quality, you know, messages that we've been shouting about all along. So we started at the same time as the men, and we covered off the full distance of the Tour de France on a relay on our turbos. So the UK riders, five of us, all met up in Wales. We had a base there, and then we had three riders in America, one in Holland, Netherlands, and one in Australia. And we just did it round the clock till we completed the distance of the tour, which was 3,400 kilometers. We did it in just under 100 hours, which was pretty cool.
Nice.
We did 2.5 hour stints each, which actually was harder than we thought. We thought that would be the easy part of plan B, because the second part was moving on to the elevation of the tour. We thought we'll cover the distance first, that'd be fine. But actually going for it for 2.5 hours on turbo is pretty tough.
So how many stints did that equate to everyone?
Four.
10 hours on. Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, it was harder than I thought.
Yeah.
So did that, got it done. We then had a rest day, and then to cover off the elevation of the tour, all of us Everested on the same day, and that that was tough. as well, because we weren't exactly fresh going into it. Our legs were sore from having done all the blinking turbo stuff. The five of us in Wales all did it on a mountain there called the Buch. Carmen in Netherlands somehow found a hill and did it outside in the Netherlands, which is incredible.
She must have done it on a bridge. There's no hill there.
Million reps. Oh man, that was a long day. I think she was about 21 hours or something.
How many reps did she end up doing?
Oh gosh, she had to do more than 60, I think.
So
it was crazy. I can't believe she did it.
When I went to the Netherlands last, which was pretty much a year ago now, I went out there to go for some like work meetings, and I met with a friend of mine, and he was like, "Oh, I'm going to take you to one of the big hills here." I was like, "Oh yeah, cool." So, and it was like in some like residential estate, like really beautiful, stunning, like cobbled road. Rode up this hill, and he was like, and I carried on, and he was like, "No, stop!" And I was like, "What do you mean stop?" He's like, "That's it, that's the hill." I was like, "This is the same as going over a bridge in central London." And he was like, "Seriously?" I'm like, "Yeah, like Box Hill is bigger than this."
Yes.
Box Hill.
I don't know where it was, but yeah, she found a hill. And as you can imagine, not many people have Everested in the Netherlands. So yeah, I think she's possibly the first female to do it. I can't remember. I need to look back on the Hall of Fame on Everesting. But so she did it outside. And then our Australian JA, she did it on Zwift, but because she was like, "I'm never doing this again, I might as well tick off all the achievements," she carried on and did 10,000 meters to unlock that Everesting achievement. And then our Americans, the two Texan girls, Michelle and Heather, they both did it on Zwift, but didn't go for the 10,000. But Jen, our Californian, had an absolute nightmare. She was doing it in somewhere near Hollywood outside, but it was on the day where there's all those crazy fires and it was a million degrees. So she nearly melted into the pavement. And I think about halfway through, she was like, "Man, I'm either going to die doing this, like, or I give up." So she actually went home, got some sleep, which is against the rules, but she was just like, "I can't do this." Yeah. And then went back the next day and did some more. But yeah, so all of us Everested, the bunch of us in Wales, we did it in just under 17 hours. And I picked us a hill. I don't know if you know it. Do you know the book? It's in the Dragon Ride, if you've ever done that one. It's beautiful.
It's about three ways up it, though, isn't there?
Yes, exactly. So I wanted to do that hill because I thought it was a good one, and looked at the different ways up it and chose the one that had the longest way up, just so you could get into a good rhythm. And it was a steady gradient. One of the ways, although it was a beautiful way, the other side, it had a section in it which is like 14-15%, and I just thought, after a couple of hundred kilometers, that's going to hurt. So our one was an average of 5-6%, which actually you can do forever. So even though we had to do more kilometers, we had to do 330k, like going up and down for the whole thing, but it never got to a stage where you couldn't turn your legs anymore. So it was good, and it wasn't a technical descent, and it was really open and beautiful. So I actually really liked it, but I paced myself. I dropped back a little bit. I was struggling to eat, so then was just doing like, you know, carbs in the bottle instead of trying to eat actual food and stuff. And once I stopped like panicking about it all, I actually just enjoyed it, and we all had a really good time. We all finished within about half an hour of each other, which was cool because I thought we would be more spread out than that. But
yeah, that's really good that you'll finish quite close, because I didn't know who, like, Who was first out of the five?
Jess and Lucy.
Of course.
Finished together. But actually, I don't know if it might have... It probably would have been Rhianne and Jules, but they had major mechanicals. Jules' bike just completely broke. Her DI2 occasionally will just drain instantly, and then other times lasts forever. Hers completely bust, so she... Although she was in the easiest gear for going up, she was then actually really struggling to pedal going down. So we tried to fix her bike for a bit. And then Rhianne's cassette on her bike came loose. So they had a couple of absolutely terrible mechanicals, which luckily we had Lucy's husband, Mo, is pretty handy as a mechanic. So he was there helping. Rob had his bike there too. So Jules ended up doing more than half of the Everesting on Rob's bike.
Which is probably what, a couple of sizes too big for her?
Oh, at least. She's tiny. She's short like me. And yeah, so I mean, she was on the wrong bike, but she just wanted to get it done. So she suffered afterwards, being, you know, we're so uncomfortable for so long, but still managed to do it. But yeah, so Jess and Lucy were nails. They were like, right, let's get this done. Whereas I was like, I was watching my heart rate and I was watching my watts, and I just thought, I really don't want to overcook this. So I think I'm really cautious, and actually Lucy says I'm a sandbagger, which is, she's fairly accurate with that. I hold back just in case. And then when I finish stuff, I'm fresh and I'm just like, oh man, I could have given it more, but I just really wanted to enjoy the day and make sure I finished. And I didn't want to burn all my matches early on. So yeah, but it was all within about half an hour of each other that we finished, which was pretty cool.
The thing is as well, like, you're better off, I probably sit on the side of, you're better off feeling fresher at the end than feeling fucked at the end. Because like, you want, it's not something you're going to do every day at the end of the day, and you want to enjoy it.
Yeah. It was an amazing experience. I really loved it. And yeah, I was happy it was over. And it was a long day, having seen sun, you know, sunrise and then sunset on quite a long day of the year. But it was amazing. I loved it.
So what would be your tips to someone who wants to do an Everest?
Plan the hill. Because if you have one that's super steep, yes, you will have to do much less distance. But if you're not comfortable on steep gradients and stuff, especially after hours of doing it, that would be a nightmare. And with something steep, it could have a sketchy descent as well. So choose the hill that suits you, and support team. We had Lucy and Mo had their camper van at the bottom, which had a toilet in it, which was amazing, and food and stuff like that. And then we had people at the top as well, just marking off the laps and giving us cheers. And a few people joined us during the day for support and stuff too, like riding up and down with us. So yeah, I think research it, have some support if you can, even if it's just your car parked up with loads of stuff in it. Because you think about all the stuff you want to eat on the bike and how you're going to fuel yourself on the day. You must know yourself with some of your major endurance stuff. You then want really weird stuff that you've never wanted before, or you just want simple stuff, or you don't want to eat anymore. So you just need like pure carbs in the bottle, like powder in the bottle and stuff. So you just got to have everything you own. All the outfit changes too. Like, oh, do you remember when you did that 24 when it just pissed it down? And even though you took all your clothes, you were out of clothes within what, 5 or 6 hours?
That would have been 2017 National 24, where it was July. It was July, and it was -4 at night, and it was a storm, and it was hailing and raining. And yeah, I ran out of clean kit. I ran out of dry kit, and I got pneumonia. So I took everything. I literally took all the kit I had. I took, I think, 3 skin suits and about 5 or 6 different jackets and like every bit of winter kit I had, and because I knew the weather forecast was going to be bad. And I pulled out, I think, after 18 hours.
Yeah, you did most of it. I remember at the time just thinking, oh my God, what has happened to the weather?
I was fucked. I got pneumonia, and then that then progressed on to shingles.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God, we were ill all over Christmas and everything, weren't
we? Very, very poorly for until really probably I think March. Because the shingles came on. I got that diagnosed the day after my birthday, so 19th of December. I went to the doctors and they diagnosed it, gave me some magical tablets, which you it's like 10 days worth. And if you caught it early enough, they would help massively. But it takes weeks and months to get over because of the it causes chronic fatigue.
Yeah.
And it's something that now I have to be like, once you've had it, you have to be really cautious of it again. So I have to which is why after my 107 challenge I've just done, that's why I took basically a month off. So it's like, I need to, if I start trying to do stuff, I'm just gonna cause it to come back. And there's a lot of things with shingles. Like, some people think it's some people don't get it that bad.
Yeah.
And some people get it very, very bad. And I definitely was on the worst scale of it. But effectively, it's what it is your nervous system's attacking itself.
Right.
So, but it only affects one side of your body. which is really weird. Yeah, literally straight down the middle. So for me, it was my right side, and I had like a rash all down my right arm, all down my right chest, all down my back, and you literally could see a line like that down my back and my chest.
So weird, isn't it?
Yeah, and the only way I can describe it is like, you know, if you like accidentally touch an electric fence.
Yes.
That's like the feeling that was like every couple of minutes was like, like just jarring through you. And then the continual feeling of it was like pins and needles.
Do you ever take beta alanine and get that fizzing kind of, is it like that?
Yeah, that kind of feeling. Yeah, that's why I don't like taking it.
I had it, well, I normally take it every day, but I forgot a few days last week. And then when I took it again, I was like, oh, my ears were tingling. I was like, oh God, I forgot about this. It's weird.
Yeah, it's to do with a few, because people, with beta alanine, you have to like dose, you have to basically like, you like load it and then you should take a break from it, and then you load it and take a break from it. I'm sure that's right. I try not to take many supplements unless I'm really racing or anything. Yeah. Try not to. Like, I won't take supplements in the winter really, apart from vitamin D and iron. Yeah,
vitamins and stuff, yeah.
If I wouldn't take anything else, like I wouldn't take creatine or beta alanine or anything like that. Don't need it. But yeah, it was that was a shit time, shingles time. Yeah. And that was probably the hardest national 24 I've done, and I didn't even finish it.
You just can't plan for crazy stuff like that. So I think, yeah, with Everesting, just take everything you own and hope for the best. And well, luckily with the camper van that was there, Lucy had like a little bathroom cabinet in there with a bunch of medication and stuff, because I started getting heartburn as well. I think because I'd had a load of sweet stuff. So then I was like, felt a bit refluxy. So I had some of that. And then my back was aching. So I had some ibuprofen. I was like, gosh, I kept going up to the medicine cabinet, like trying to get all the stuff to make sure I could complete the day.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So I think, you know, planning and hoping for the best, hoping for not torrential rain is probably a good thing to do for Everesting.
Yeah. What about for long term? I know you like me are a turbo fiend. Like, yeah. I think both of us can just, I don't know, but I'm not fazed by it. And I know you're pretty similar. It's just a case of you, especially your structured stuff, you just get on and do it. What are your like little tips for people who are maybe, especially going into lockdown again, and then secondly, going into winter? What would your tips be on that?
A combination of stuff. One, Netflix, TV. I have my turbo set up right in front of the telly just to take my mind off it, because it's incredibly boring. Even with Zwift, with all its gamification and stuff like that, you don't want to just sit and look at that for hours and hours. So I watch stuff on, you know, documentaries or films or whatever on TV. This morning I was watching the crazy US election, like what is going on here? good shorts. Chamois cream. I only use it if I'm doing a long session or something. But yeah, you know, proper padded shorts and stuff. I wear Atticus like you do, and no problem at all with them. Just so you're comfy. Make sure your bike fits you properly. All that definitely would help. Otherwise, sometimes you can get like pins and needles in your hands, or, you know, saddle issues and stuff like that. And then just build up to it, really. I couldn't have spent hours on the turbo the first time I got one, but just now built up to it. I don't love the long ones. Even now, I've done some major long ones, and I still get a bit daunted by it. Get all your stuff ready beforehand as well. Actually, that's a pain if you have to get off to go and get more water and stuff like that. So I'd line up all the bottles next to me I think I'd need. And then, yeah, just get it done.
I think my biggest thing for it is I have this thing, which I explain it to a lot of people, about what I call barriers to completion.
Oh, yes, okay.
So anything that's a barrier to completion of a task, whatever that task is, whether it is, writing a book or something, whatever it is. So in the turbo, barriers to completion for me is having a bike already in the turbo. So I permanently have a bike in the turbo trainer, because it means that I don't have to set it up. I can just jump on it. I don't have to think about it. Having the whole setup there ready and done because then it stops you faffing massively. Yes. And if I need to, yeah, and like it means you can delay a session from start, say like you get up in the morning and you're trying to do one before doing some work, and yeah. you it's there, like literally my turbo is next to my bed, so I literally get up in the morning, plug the laptop in, set it all up, make a coffee, have some food, go.
It's the best way. I find myself procrastinating way too often, and I've got little boys at school, so I'll go and do the school run, and the best time to do it is as soon as I've done the school run, get on, but I inadvertently start doing some work, or I go and do something else, and then before I know it, it's lunchtime, and I think, oh, I need to have some food, so I'll do that, and then before I know it, it's the school run again, and then I think, oh gosh, and then I'm in the evening after they've gone to bed doing it, so I'm on my turbo at 9 o'clock at night, which is just awful. Really is dumb doing it, but I let that happen way too often. Procrastination is bad.
Yeah, I'm pretty insistent. If it gets to anything much later than 8 o'clock, I won't do it. I just won't do it in the evening, because I'd rather just reschedule it, just do it another day, and go, okay, this has become a rest day, move it across. Because otherwise, say for example, I've got a turbo session tomorrow and I did it at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and then the next day, for example, tomorrow I've got an hour and a half session, which is basically intervals. Mm-hmm. And what day are we on? And then Friday I've got like 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
So if I end up doing an hour and a half really late, that 3.5 hours is going to be shit quality.
It is, yeah, because it'll only be like 12 hours later or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. You get the recovery in. So what I would do is I would just go, okay, I'm shifting everything back a day, and then just lose a rest day.
Yeah.
Which is not ideal, but that's the situation you have to be in, I guess. Cool. The other thing I wanted to talk about, so we kind of covered what internationals is, which is, if you do not know, follow it on social media, all that jazz. I'm going to put links in wherever the fuck I put them, somewhere. You kind of covered what happened this year, which was a very strange year, definitely. Yeah. And then, so we had the Tour de France route presentation 2 days ago?
On Sunday evening. It was meant to be last Thursday, but then because France is messed up with coronavirus and stuff, they decided to just do it virtually online on Sunday night. So yeah, I was pretty excited to watch it for a couple of reasons. One, to see the route that we would ride next year going on our campaign again. And secondly, to hear about this famous 2022 Women's Tour de France that we've been hearing about.
The Women's Tour de France. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, so they've been saying, the UCI have mentioned it, ASO hadn't said much about it, so I thought, oh, you know, this would be a great opportunity for them to tell people about what they're doing for women's cycling and stuff. And yeah, the presentation was an hour long, and they dedicated 31 seconds to women's cycling.
And what happened in that 31 seconds as well?
They said, there will be a Women's Tour de France in 2022. And that was all that was said about that. They said it would be a stage race. So I don't know if that's 2 stages or 10 stages. I very much doubt it's going to be 21 stages like the men have got. But that was all they said, a stage race in 2022. And then that finished. And then later on in the presentation, they mentioned La Course, which is the women's equivalent. And they confirmed that next year it's just one stage again. And it's not even the full stage. It's like 5 laps of the Mur de Bretagne or something.
So the thing with La Course is, it's always, I feel like it's just always been a bit of a joke.
It's a box ticking exercise. It's like, yeah, we've done women's cycling. It's crap. Yeah. It's basically a crit race when they've done it around Paris, or this year it was meant to be around Paris, and they actually changed it to be that first stage in Nice. And the race was unbelievable. It was, you know, a proper close finish, and Lizzie Dinan won just, and it's always amazing, but it's never enough. They get less than 3 hours racing and the men get 3 weeks. That, I mean, how is that fair on any level at all?
Do you know what I think one of the other big problems is the fact that the Giro Rosa is the same time?
Absolutely. Yeah, so the Rosa gets no attention at all because everyone's watching the Tour de France. And actually this year, it got no coverage at all, which broke the UCI guidelines. So the Giro Rose has been booted off the Women's World Tour list next year. So, yeah. And but you know what? Being on at the same time, if they did it properly, it could work well, because everyone's so obsessed with cycling at the time because the tour's on. If they worked the coverage properly, you could go from one show to another and do it. But because they can't be bothered, and because maybe people aren't shouting enough for women's cycling, that they're not doing it. So that's what we're trying to do too, is we're letting people know, did you know there is no Women's Tour de France because of all these reasons, which are, you know, pretty much rubbish. And this is what you can do to help. And it's watch the races when they're on, go to races if you can, talk to your friends about women's cycling, and just make women on bikes being a more normal thing, from grassroots all the way up to pro level. We just need help every step of the way, unfortunately, because it's so far behind the men's sport.
Yeah, and I think there's the thing as well, like, how I see it is, like, the women's racing is often much more interesting to watch. It normally, so often, it's way more aggressive, it's definitely very tactical, but it's way more aggressive, and it's way more, like, racing. It probably isn't, but it comes across and it's much more racing on feel, and like attacks just happen. It's like watching, if you watch like the under 23 world champs, men's and women's, they don't have radios. It's a similar sort of thing, you know, and so those races are always just like bam, 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 attack, attack, attack.
I think because the women's races are often so much shorter, there's none of the pissing around in the middle. Some of the men's races are so long, they'll start off and they'll just dwindle around really until the last, 10K or whatever. And then an attack will happen. Whereas the women, like, are racing from the gun.
Yeah.
And it is incredible. And breakaways happen all the time, and then chasing groups. And it's brilliant to watch. It really is. But sometimes it's just so hard to watch because it's just not televised. Or if it is, it's just harder to find. You know, even during the World Championships, the men's race was on BBC and the women's race was on the Red Button.
Yeah.
So people aren't stumbling across it, and you can't inspire people to be involved in stuff if they don't know about it or aren't seeing it.
You have to make it as easy as possible for people at the end of the day. People are lazy. Yeah. You need to make it as easy for people to find as possible. And being on the Red Button is that what I was saying earlier about having these barriers that stop you doing things.
Yes,
having to find something on a freaking Red Button on a TV remote is a barrier. And so it's not easy, because human beings are naturally lazy. And then, I mean, the other thing for me is, one of the things that I like about women's cycling is that, in my opinion, I don't think this is necessarily true opinion to everyone, but in my opinion, you don't tend to have people that are so, like, you're a sprinter, you're a time trialist, you're a climber. It seems much more that many of the women can do all of it.
All-rounders, yeah.
So that means that the racing is actually way more interesting, because, for example, Marianne Vos, she can sprint, she can climb, she can time trial. She's probably the best cyclist racing. She's probably the best cyclist racing currently. Like, take out anyone that's retired, like, actually performing at the moment. And equally, you look at Lizzie Deignan, she can sprint, she can climb, she can time trial. You look at, like, I mean, they're obviously going to be bits that they're stronger at or weaker at. But if you compare it to the men's side, it's very, very clear who's a sprinter. Like, you look at, for example, you look at the build of Christoph, he looks like a bloody weightlifter. And then you compare him to Chris Froome, And then also then chuck into that a time trialist guy like Rowan Dennis. I mean, Rowan Dennis is probably more on the climbing side, but the physiology of it, I feel, is very different on the men's side than the women's side. I feel like that's personal opinion, but it seems that most of the women, especially at that level, are very much can do all of it,
which makes it exciting, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly, that's why the racing becomes exciting, because it's so unpredictable. Like, you watch one of the men's grand tour, and it goes, so sprinter stage, a sprinter's probably going to win it unless a breakaway happens. There's been times and occasions when that's not happened, obviously. Or I remember one stage a couple of years ago in the Tour de France where Sagan and Chris Froome crossed the line together. And it was a sprinter stage. That doesn't happen very often. you look at the time trial, for example, like, I mean, there's very few individual women's time trials, very few. There's quite often women's team time trials, very few individual women's time trials. But you look at the, on the time trialing side, I mean, the Tour de France time trial that was the second to last stage was an anomaly. We'll take that as a complete anomaly, because yeah, that was just a guy absolutely racing through his skin to win. And then Primoz just having an absolute bender and a blow up, basically. But, you know, you look at, and also it wasn't really a time trial. It was a time trial with a fucking hill in it. So, yeah.
That hill, we did that last year. That Planche aux Belles Filles is a bloody nightmare. I was zigzagging up a bit. There's a bit where it says Pino, Pino, Pino on the road. That bit is a joke. It's ridiculous. The fact they were having to change their bikes halfway through, it just showed what a ridiculous stage it was, going from a TT bike to their climbing bike. It's like, what sort of stage is this?
And it's it's not really a true time trial. So the proper time trialist guys do not do well on that.
No, it's crazy.
The other thing that I think is really important to note is that, so this year, obviously, we had, what, 100 days of racing in, what, 50-odd days or something, 60 days, yeah? And they've made the coverage work across multi... Yeah. Like, you have the Vuelta and the Giro running at the same time.
Yeah, so there's no argument that there isn't time to slot a women's race in amongst all the men's races and stuff. It's not an argument. And that's the thing. Each time someone gives us a barrier for why we can't do this, we're like, well, you can, you just don't want to.
Yeah, there's a lot of proof this year that things can be done. And like, we have to be thankful that we've managed to see as much racing on the men's and women's side that we have seen this year. Like, it's been pretty incredible to actually, that most pretty much, I mean, fingers crossed, all the Grand Tours should finish.
I couldn't believe that. When Prudhomme came down with thinking coronavirus halfway through the tour, I was thinking, geez, this Tour de France is never going to finish. I just thought they would cut it at any point. They all came down with it. And then in the Giro, a couple of riders had to leave and stuff. So it's a miracle.
Out, didn't they, in the Giro?
Yeah, it's a miracle. It's a shame that Paris-Roubaix didn't happen, because that was going to be a first for women. That was very exciting. And that just popped up on the calendar, but then hasn't happened. So hopefully it will be on next year.
I really hope so, because that is, that's one of the, for me, one of the best races in the year. It'd be such a shame if it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Because I really like that there's a Women's Flanders, but the prize money is completely just wrong.
Yeah, that's another thing we outline and stuff too. Like, so for until the Giro Rosa lost its World Tour status, it was basically the, you know, the big stage race for women. The top prize for the Giro Rosa is €5,000. The top prize for the biggest men's stage race, the Tour de France, is €500,000. It's just like, the prize money is ridiculous. And I understand people's reasonings about, you know, not getting the coverage and not getting sponsorship and this, that and the other, but that needs to change, because it's not fair that so many of our women pros have to have full-time jobs as well as racing, and then not getting the minimum wage and stuff like that. And it's just terrible. How do we expect them to perform as well as they can with all of the other stuff that they have to do too? They're almost being set up to fail.
Yeah, it's really sad. And then we've had what? We've had two women's team have folded this year.
Yeah.
CCC is...
A new one cropping up, which is great, but Jumbo-Visma have got a new team for next year. But yeah, your sponsors just... Which I know is difficult because of the year we've had and businesses are going bust and stuff like that, but it's like... It's tough.
It's happening on the men. That team's folding is happening on the men's side as well. CCC, men's and women's teams gone.
Yes.
NTT is probably gone. They've not found a new replacement sponsor. There's a lot of riders that are out of contract.
Yeah.
There is. But then, I mean, Jumbo-Visma. So... The interesting thing with the Jumbo-Visma starting a women's team was that was a criteria that Cervelo insisted.
Okay.
Cervelo were coming on board as a bike sponsor. Part of the agreement was there needs to be a women's team. But it is something that Jumbo-Visma had been discussing anyway. So, but they were pretty much like, yeah, you need to do that. which is really, really good. But I quite like, I feel that it is right that teams should have a men's and a women's team as well.
Yeah. It would be great if Ineos would do that as well. You know, they lead the way in so many areas that they should have a women's team. They really should.
They should, 100%. Because they've got the budget at the end of the day. Yeah. This is the stupid thing about it, is that financially they have the budget to do it. Jumbo Visma, yeah, part of the reason that they've been able to do it is because their budget is, I think, maybe a third of Ineos's.
Right.
But they still have budget to be able to do it. And the budget will be increasing next year with changes of sponsors and stuff. But then, yeah, I try and think, like, Movistar has a men's and a women's team. Jumbo Visma will. Mitchelton Scott do. Who else is there?
Sunweb
do. I think that's maybe it.
Mm.
At world tour level. I'm going to have a quick look. FDJ cycling teams. Quickstep don't, UAE don't, Astana don't, Lotto Soudal does, Bahrain McLaren doesn't, EF doesn't, NTT doesn't, Jumbo Visma will, Ineos doesn't, Trek Segafredo does,
yes,
Agi two don't, Bora don't, Israel Startup Nation don't, Confidis does, Movistar does, Arkea Samsig does. So quite a few of them do. There's a few exceptions, definitely. I mean, Israel Startup, Bora,
NTT. Ineos not having one is crazy with the budgets that they have.
I know, it's insane, isn't it?
What
I think needs to happen is, personally, I feel like, if more of the bigger teams like actually do it, it's going to help a lot.
Absolutely, it will drive the whole agenda for the races and everything, because all their sponsors will want to be seen on the stage.
Yeah.
So they will want that. That will drive everything.
Mm.
It certainly is the way forward. So things are moving in a better direction, and there's. You know, there's no argument that women's sport isn't exciting anymore. We saw with a couple of years ago, the Women's World Cup and stuff, the viewing figures were incredible and people loved tuning in and watching women's sport. So all the stuff people say is, you know, women can't play sport and this, that and the other. It's just rubbish now. We just need to have a chance to be seen. Even recently, I saw just yesterday, so all the men's FA Cup stuff is carrying on through this second lockdown. All the women's FA Cup stuff stopping, and it's just like, what? Always being a second-class citizen, it's just not okay. And we're not asking for anything special. We're just asking for the same treatment, just some equality. Not anything more, but just not less all the time.
Seems to be a case of, like, three steps forward, one step back all the time. Yeah. That's what it seems to be. That's what I've noticed. I think the thing is that, like, in cycling especially, the general public who are into cycling want it.
Yes.
The problem is that is such a niche of a niche of a niche.
Niche, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And it's just not even reported, like, even in the men's cycling, which it should be huge. It doesn't make the news. Like that crazy stage in the Vuelta the other day with that hill, which I'm so glad is not in bloody France, because otherwise I might have to ride it one day. Won by a Brit. Was it on TV? Nope.
Yeah.
That should make the news.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's just, the whole of cycling needs a boost, that's for sure. But yeah, the women's side of it, oh gosh, it needs help, which is why we're doing what we're doing, to try and push things along and bring things out of the dark ages and shine a light on women's sport in general, but particularly cycling.
So then the last thing I want to cover is, what does the route for 2021 look like? Because all I know is that Vontu is happening twice. I've not even looked at it.
Yeah, it's actually really good. So that was one of the things this year, was that, you know, obviously I wanted to go and do the tour and was gutted when we didn't go, but I wasn't bothered about the route particularly. I kind of wanted to try that new Col de la Loz one up to Meribel, but when I saw it on TV, I was like, ugh, that looks horrible. I'm glad I didn't go. But next year's is really great. So the start has changed. It was going to be in Copenhagen, but with it going to next year, the Olympics happening next year, they couldn't do the start. So that's gone from Copenhagen and is now in Brest in northwest France, spending 3 days up there and then moving down. And it's basically from the start is bonkers. There's two TTs, whereas this year there was only one. So I think one's a team time trial and one's an individual. And one of the PTs is right at the end again, just like this year, so it keeps the, you know, suspense and stuff like that. So I think that's designed a similar way. And 27 cols in total. So yeah, Von 2 is in there twice, which is pretty exciting. I've never ridden Von 2, so I'm wondering if we might do it all three ways just to do the full Tour de France and that. That might be a bit ambitious. And then some of the classics again. So Tourmalet's in it, which we did last year, but I think it's going up the other way. Popping into Andorra, that's the highest point on the tour this year. I've never cycled in Andorra, apparently some great stuff there. The usual stuff, Pyrenees and Alps. But yes, a lot of beautiful climbs, which I'm really excited about. A few that I've done already, but then some ones to tick off. And then heading back to Tien, because the pros never made it there, like we were talking about earlier with the landslide stuff that cut that route short. So they never made it up that final climb. So Tien is on there. And then actually there's a rest day in Tien, which was pretty cool. It's a really cool town, the big lake and stuff. So the route's beautiful. It's going to be stunning. And hopefully good weather, not too hot. It'll be a bit earlier because of the Olympics. So yeah, it's end of June for 3 weeks. So it's going to be massive. I'm going to, you know, have to train my butt off again for it to make sure I can complete it all. But yeah, it'll be beautiful.
Nice. Yeah, amazing. I've not properly looked at the route. The big thing that stuck out to me was the fact that there's going to be Bontu twice. And it doesn't actually look as hilly as this year was.
Okay.
Like, and I always wonder if they've set up the Tour de France to basically favour Alaphilippe as many ways as they can.
Pretty much. Yeah. They want a French winner for sure.
Wait, what, has it been 30 odd years or something stupid like that?
Yeah.
It must be about. Yeah,
I'm sure that's what they did this year, and then I'm sure that's next year as well. I don't know what the total amount of climbing and stuff is, but yeah, the Von 2 stage worries me a little bit. It's a downhill finish, so there's a col before it, I can't remember which one it is now, then up Von 2, down, then kind of round a little loop, and then up the classic Von 2 way for Bedouin, and then down, and the finish is at the bottom. And I just like, oh god, I hate downhill, like
the descent is
just so dangerous.
That descent, so if they're going up to, I've got it in front of me, so Chalet Reynard, you go up to Chalet Reynard. So you start in Salut, and then you go up to Chalet Reynard, then up to Bontu, down, and then you go, the second time is from Bedouin up, and then you just, you're basically doing the two, the nicest ones, I would say.
Yeah.
That's stage 11.
We should go in another one just to join the Club de Sangla. Have you done that? You must have.
Yeah, I did it with Jess.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, the day you were going to do it, it was so windy, like your bike's flying away, so you end up doing the next day.
Yeah, the day we were going to do it, I was on my S5, which had 80 mil carbon rims on it. And I'll say it now. It wasn't my choice. That was George who asked me to ride 80 mil carbon rims.
Oops.
Yeah, and I was quite... Cool pictures. Pardon?
The cool pictures.
Yeah, basically. I was an 80 mil on the front and a 50 on the rear, and I was riding a standard crank set on the bike, so 5339 with an 1128 cassette.
Oh no, I wouldn't like that.
Yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't at all. But then, I mean, I was flying on the descents, absolutely flying on the descents. But I'm, you know, I'm a massive convert to disc brakes, and I wasn't riding a disc brake bike on doing that. And I was just thinking, fuck, I remember there's one point, and I think it was a descent going into Salt, where I was like, I'm doing 80 kilometers an hour right now. there's a very sharp corner in front of me, and I don't think I'm going to brake quick enough.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that happened a few times.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. Like, I would, I'd love to go out there and do that again. It's beautiful. Just Bontu is like, it's one of those climbs that you have to tick off because it is so.
Absolutely. I was delighted it was on the list. I was hoping Alpe d'Huez might be on there just to tick it off. People have done it like, oh, it's no big deal. It's not that great, stuff like that. But it's bucket list stuff, isn't it?
I've never done Alpe d'Huez.
No.
No. I've not done a lot. I've done very little cycling in France. I've done more in Spain.
Yes.
I've done Chalet Reynard and like that part and Ventoux and around that area. And then I've done Roubaix.
Oh, yes.
And that's it. All the cycling up in France.
Routes like Galibier, Izoard, all that stuff. It's so beautiful.
Hmm. I don't know why I haven't. I just haven't done it. I've done way more in Spain and Italy as well. Way more in Italy. In fact, probably Italy is probably the most.
Yes.
Done Stelvio.
Oh, cool.
4 times.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, I've got to do that.
And I remember the last time I did Stelvio, it was, me and one of my mates got up really early for sunrise. We started in Bormio, which is the base, and it was pitch black. So the idea was to ride up it as the sun was going up. And then we did it like, must have been like September time. So it was like, it was beautiful. It was pink. It's like such a pink sunrise as well. Got to the top and there's a little cafe at the top. And you see it on the Giro on that stage. So they go straight past the cafe. And we did it the way in the Giro they did it. We did it the opposite way at that time. Because they went up it, what I would say is probably the harder way to go up. But maybe not as pretty. To be honest, it's pretty both ways. But the way, because we were staying in Bormio, the way that they, the way that they didn't go up it, the way that we went up it, which is, that's basically Bormio, is at the bottom of it. So it's like, okay, we can roll straight up it. And there's a little cafe at the top, got an espresso and some little like, cake thing, sat at the top for a while, watched the sun go up a little bit more, and then descended it, and it was the coldest descent I've ever done.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so cold. It's amazing. so cold. Like, that point where you're just like, I had gloves and everything, and I was just like, fuck, I can't feel my fingers.
You can't feel the brakes or anything either.
But that was when I was there, that was when I first got my first ever disc brake road bike.
Okay.
And I was like, thank fuck for this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I've been I've pretty much been on disc brakes for 4 years.
Wow.
Pretty much, on and off.
Yeah.
And almost everything now is disc brake. It's so much better. So much better. Stops.
Right. I've yet to convert because it's not on my pink bike, but I do want a disc brake bike, so I might have to just put the pink bike on the wall someday and get a new one.
Yeah, a new pink bike.
It has to be a pink one. And I do love Bianchi, so I don't know. But it has to be pink for sure.
They've just brought out a new Bianchi, haven't they? I don't know what, I know nothing about it, but it's disc brake.
Yes, yeah. The one I have is a Specialissima that is available with disc now. Is that nuts to buy the same bike again just with disc?
I think if you like a bike and it fits you, that's why not? That's my theory on it. Like if you specifically like a bike and a brand, like why not just get the same bike? Like it's not the same. It's going to be different still. It's going to have different wheels, different components. It's going to feel different because it's a newer frame.
Yeah.
It's going to be like, you look at, I don't know, like for prime examples, you look at my S5 that I have, which I had it when my one, I bought it third hand. It used to be a pro one. That's rim brake. Yeah. But you look at the new S5, which is a completely different looking bike.
Yeah.
With the crazy handlebars. Mm-hmm. I I don't think it's a problem. Go for the same bike and same brand if you like them. I mean, you've got a Bianchi out in America as well.
I've got an XR4, which is the one that the Jumbo Visma team use for the tours and everything. So, I mean, that's a sweet bike. That's more of an aero one. So it's not as light as the Specialissima, but it's a sweet bike. And I've got real nice Envy wheels on that one. And it's a fast, fast bike, but I can't be trusted with it on hills. Basically, it doesn't stop because they're such sweet carbon wheels. If there's any form of moisture on the road, you just, the brakes don't really work. So I actually delaminated one of the wheels descending in the Alps a couple of years ago, and bike shop were like, nope, we're taking those wheels off you if you can't behave with them. I just use the brakes too much. I was just riding, I'm cautious descending, so I use the brakes a lot. And yeah, I delaminated one of them. So luckily it was warranted, so I got a new one, but they were just like, you're not doing any hilly stuff on these. So I deliberately put those wheels on the bike in America, and Texas is flat as a pancake, so that bike stays out there. Yeah. I'm not going to get myself in any trouble descending and brakes not working. So I haven't been able to go there since February with all of the blinking travel restrictions and stuff, but do crit races and stuff in Texas on that bike. And yeah, I love it. It's great.
So this is where you are, I think, your prime person who should have disc brakes.
I think so too. It would just help me just with the confidence of knowing that I can stop on the descents and stuff. So yeah, it's the way forward. Okay, fine, I'll buy another bike.
I think that
was a sell, wasn't it?
That was a successful podcast. What happened to Lou? I convinced her to buy another bike. Yeah, you know, and also the next thing I'd say, and this is a controversial thing with disc brakes as well. So I've just upgraded my Aspera, my gravel bike, which I'm pointing at because it's here. I've just changed it from mechanical to DI2. And the reason why is, so since I got hit by a car last year, I've been struggling with really bad nerve damage. And
oh, right.
And it's that motion which is painful, which is exactly the motion for shifting a mechanical group set.
Yeah. DI2 is lush. You just basically just tap it, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. So especially for the long distance stuff, it is so much better. But anyway, so I've changed my Sparrow over to DI2 GRX, which is the gravel group set. And the shifters, they may look strange, but they are the most comfortable shifters I've ever used. Ergonomically, they're incredible.
Yes.
Really, really good. And the actual braking, the modulation, feels better than any of the other Shimano shifters.
Do you think when I get my disc brake bike, I'll go down a hill and I'll use the brakes and I'll stop and fly off because I won't be used to brakes actually working?
I think you'll be really surprised at how much of a difference it makes. I really do. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. And I think it'll do, I've been saying the same to Jess, like it'll do so much more for her because Jess isn't a confident descender either. I think it'd really.
And it's a shame when you're such a good climber because you lose so much time being so cautious descending after you've whipped everyone's butts on the way up.
Yeah, it's exactly that. I mean, she's got a gravel bike, which is disc brakes. And I would imagine she's probably been eyeing up a disc brake road bike. I know she was, when we were chatting ages ago, she was saying if you guys were to have gone out for the tour this year, she probably would have bought a disc brake road bike.
Yeah.
I said to her, like, if you don't do that, put aluminium braking surface wheels on as a minimum because it stops better.
Yes. Yeah. I will both get new bikes then for next year.
Yeah, why don't you just all get new bikes? Everyone on the team next year has a new bike. I mean, you deserve it. Your pink one's definitely done some serious kilometres.
I'd put it on the wall now. It's so sentimental to me, all the stuff that I've done on that bike.
Yeah.
And how much my life has changed since I got it as well, that it's just, I'd frame it. I certainly wouldn't sell it at all, ever.
Nah, it wouldn't be right to sell it.
No. But yeah, maybe some new bikes. But it's funny because we have had, you know, sponsors come to us before and say, you know, would you be interested in all being on X bike? But we've all got such different tastes and everyone loves their own bikes that that's one thing we don't need as, you know, sponsorship is bikes, because we want our own to ride. That, you know, the biggest test you're going to do, you want to be on your own bike.
Yeah, you want to. The thing is, it's not just that. It's one, you want to be on your own bike. Two, you want, like, I think it's also you need to have the time on the bike to feel comfortable and confident on it as yeah. well. And especially yeah. for something like that, you wouldn't just ride on a bike without having done all your training leading up to it on it. Yeah. And for yeah. a lot of bike brands to provide 10 bikes actually is quite a big expense for a bike brand, which I don't think yeah. people realise.
No, and we ride the shit out of them on those 3 weeks.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, we can lend you some stuff. I'm like, you know, we're going to do 3,500 kilometres. They're like, what? But yeah.
People don't, I don't think, you know, like, I mean, when I did my 107 ride this year, that bike, I've still got it, the R3 I did it on, it's trashed, it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't just the distance and the amount of miles I was covering. It was also the weather conditions. It was also the amount of it that was off-road. That's not an off-road bike. It's grinding off-road loads. And it all, you know, it takes its, you know, the wheels were knackered. I went through 3 tyres.
Did you? Gosh.
Yeah, 3 tyres. I went through 3 tyres. The wheels were knackered. The frame obviously got loads of chips and scuffs on it.
Go through a chain. We all basically had a chain changed at the end of the tour last year as well.
Change the chain, change the cassette, change the chain ring. Oh, no, it didn't change the chain rings. Chain and cassette, though.
Yeah.
And the rotors. Wore the rotors out.
It's crazy, isn't it?
But in all fairness, they weren't new rotors. They weren't brand new. But and the chain and cassette weren't brand new, and the tyres weren't brand new when I started. But, okay. You know, they're perishable parts of a bike, aren't they? You expect them to wear out. I'm trying to think of anything else. There was many a thing on that bike which was not in a good way when I finished. And I literally went to my local bike shop and just went.
That's what I do. I as you know, I've been going to bicycle for absolutely years, and they actually, as soon as they see me approaching now, like, oh God. They're like, well, at least you ride it, but my God, what have you done to it now? I'm just like, I don't know, it's just making a noise.
yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah, awesome. Well, I think I'm going to actually get some lunch now. I haven't had any lunch yet.
I'm hungry too. I rushed to get my training done, had some toast before I did it actually, then fired myself in the shower, chat to you, and I'm like, oh, I'm hungry now. So yes, good plan. And some bike shopping. I'm going to go online.
yeah, go do some bike shopping. What are you going to have for lunch?
Anything I can find. I'm super hungry.
Nice. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to press this magical stop button, and thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.